welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know right now if you're driving innovation across the world of business, design, tech, and culture. Today, I'm joined by Nick Sherrod, MD and founder of Label Sessions. Nick, what have you been working on this week?
Hello. First week back in the new year, and it kind of took me by surprise last week. So what I can say is that everybody in the world at the moment wants to talk about AI agents. And also, if their company isn't very innovative, trying to find out a way to make it innovative, whether that's through a lab or something else. That seems to be the sort of, you know, just, you know, research session of my inbox from last week. That seems to be the sort of topic of the day.
We're also joined by Josh Nixon, our resident content king. Josh, how's your week been?
I definitely didn't contribute or write that content king line. But same thing.
You'd like to pick?
I love it. That's why I'm by the time. But no, so kicking off the new year as well with a lot of really good stuff, but the most notable thing that's coming up is the work that we're doing with Frill, a Financial Regulation Innovation Lab, is a place that we've been helping, and we're doing a little bit of filming for their innovation call and to address financial crime. And that's what's coming up for me.
We should also say responses to financial crime. We're not doing financial crime. This has come up a lot.
Innovation call to address,
stopping financial crime. In general, that's
blanket statement. We are not doing financial crime. Yeah. It's a new thing to put on the website, please. Also, a big welcome to Vincent Korver, maestro of sound and brand harmony, who has worked with everyone from Steinway & Son, Harrods, Mercedes-Benz, Formula One. The list just goes on and on. Vincent, as a classical pianist who also works with brands, tell us a little bit more about your story. How did you get to where you are today?
Wonderful question to pop off with. I think it's to always be hungry. As a musician, I always felt quite immediately that the world is always changing around us. And I must admit, I have had some challenges always kind of reinventing my career because the global circumstances change all the time. So, I remember I started thinking, okay, I can't just be playing piano. I love also selling instruments. And I became working for Steinway and selling pianos. And then there was the oil crisis, there was a financial crisis. And I was like, okay, I'm going to focus on music now and live performance. And then there was COVID. And then after COVID, it was like, oh, okay, now I'm going to focus on music production. And now there is AI. So there's this constant having to reposition yourself in the world of music and creativity. And this is also what's really incredibly exciting. Where I am today, I love kind of giving companies and brands a musical voice. And I realize that sound always forms triggers. And it could be memories, it could be the sound of a doorknob of your old apartment, you know, of your grandmother that will give you goosebumps. Or it could be the sound of a train underneath the balcony on your grandfather's old apartment. It's these sounds that give us an identity and a feeling. It allows us to kind of really appreciate who we are and where we came from, and music is much more than just music. I find I love working in the medical fields and currently doing hospital project music for preterm infants. I'm still doing a lot of piano concerts, which keep me really really busy. I love improvisation, writing music, working with companies in leading tech, and you know, I have a wonderful label called Stardust Music, which really focuses on music for well-being. Meditation, wellness, sleep, which is a big topic. Nick was also mentioning the other day. And I love music that has a function, not just an artistic function, but something that really, really is there for a purpose for people to maybe move a little bit slower in this increasingly fast world. So that's, kind of in a nutshell.
Vincent, has that always been your attitude? Because I could find some people who are very into classical piano who would be horrified by the whole idea of utility of music and that kind of thing. Have you always just had that instinctive desire to do that? Or is that, or is that a turning point?
It is. I think when I was young, I was 12, I realized that the recording industry was crashing as we know it. Like nobody was waiting for Chopin nocturnes anymore. Kind of the repertoire that was regurgitated and repeated all these times. I think even when I was 12, I really wanted to play modern music. I wanted to do things differently than other people. And I felt that the beauty of it is that I remember playing as a young boy for my teachers. And if I played Chopin, they had so much to say. And if I played the pieces that they never heard before, then they had nothing to say, which I thought, that's a bonus. Like, I could just play without judgment. So if I do my own thing, nobody will judge me. That's all since 1992 that I realized that.
What kind of brings us nicely to, like, what are you excited about at the moment when it comes to just sonicness in general?
The hell's part of it. So
interesting.
Music medicine is amazing. You have PTSD, you have pain management. Music can trigger so much, and sounds do as well. There's a lot of clinical trials which are very cutting edge. 40 hertz that reduces brain plaques for people with Alzheimer's, just giving them back clarity. There's just so much happening right now. And it's not just music, it's sound, it's noises. Intrinsically, we're cave people. So we know that we hear bird sounds. You know, the environment outside is safe because the birds are not singing when the bear is outside of the cave. So I realized if you put on bird sounds, people feel better. So I was like, okay, what if we do bird sounds and piano? Like, how does that work together? What is instinctively a sound trigger in people? And how can we do that to help people? The hospital project is superbly interesting right now. The sleep side, you know, there's so many people that really fall asleep with sounds and music. Biosensory input. Then there is what's called graded exposure that allows you to create a 3D sound field. And you can bring in kind of aspects of sound in space. I'm using a very advanced sound system for that with Steinway-Dindorf, which is incredible. This sound system works so well that you can actually position a sound in space. It's like the sound of a butterfly that can, you know, be whizzing around your ears in real time. And you can move that butterfly also in real time. So it's super exciting things. It goes beyond like just recorded music stereo, and you know, it creates a whole environment that's indistinguishable from real life.
That's a fascinating
thing. That's pretty cool. I'm a terrible sleeper, so I want to come back to the sleep thing at some later stage.
Well, I think sleep's the whole thing. That's why I've been talking about sleep as well. But I think it's interesting because there's so much, I guess, what you're close to, Vincent, is the new possibilities. So in terms of the new technology that allows us to create very different types of sound environment. And on the flip side, what's also happening is all kinds of people all over the world are kind of hacking their sound environment, if you like. So like you say, they're falling asleep to white noise or to some podcast. There's a whole kind of change in habit that's going on based on the current mass market tech. And then there's this really interesting move of new possibilities coming through. So it kind of becomes, you know, it's quite a fundamental thing, how we sleep. But it does feel like that. So that's an activity that's being quite transformed now.
Yep, exactly.
I think that idea, sort of like too much digital noise, brings us nicely into our first newsworthy moment over the last few months. I mean, last few weeks, sorry. In an article.
Last year, because it's still the start of the year. So last year, all that time ago.
In
2020. Damn distant past.
All the way back in 2024, there's an article called Meta's AI Users Are the Last Thing Social Media Need. Now, these AI-generated personas have been causing quite a bit of a stir and a pretty universal backlash around really the potential to not only alienate real users and blurring the lines of genuine interaction, but it also really sort of brings up the question about the future of social media as a whole. Have you guys seen these AI users? What are first impressions when you saw this?
Vincent may have experimented more than me. There's so many things I've sort of had a look at. And I think there's a really interesting thing whereby you can see there's a lot of institutions, a lot of companies right now who want to sell things that look like AI individuals. Most of the time, actually interacting with them is much less fun, much less useful, and much less of an experience. I don't know if anyone else has had. There's also some really dark patterns I've discovered in some of them, but I think that'd be my general take on this whole area right now.
Up to the next virtual girlfriend type of thing as well. What do you guys think? Is that with the robots, Tesla, the whole, yeah.
I think it's a little bit worse because I feel like inevitably you get to the point where you don't actually know it's an AI user. So I think with a virtual girlfriend, you're opting in. You're going, okay, I'm going to engage with this AI. But with these new users or personas, it sort of just pops up in your... Yeah.
You come across a lot of them on Instagram. So as well, they have a lot of followers. I think companies also starting a lot of different influencers. It seems to be a profitable game.
Yeah, at least for now. I think it's interesting because some of the AI influencers have been really creative and quite kind of interesting. There's some interesting ones that are around. But I kind of find they're interesting because there's a social media thing that feels like real people are interacting, that therefore they can interact with, and therefore it becomes interesting. It's interesting this new character turns up in a social media feed that is of real people, and that kind of operates. I just feel like there's an interesting point now where social media itself is dying away to some degree, and actually in some ways going back to kind of message boards, right? So the UK used to be the place in the world that had the most Twitter users or X users, as it is now, and that's collapsed, and people are going on to places like Blue Sky and other places. But they're essentially just like message boards like they used to be before the whole Web 2 thing supposedly happened. Or I think a lot of people are also realizing that they're painfully online, that they're too much online and trying to find ways to opt out of it. It feels like a sort of cultural moment as much as a tech moment that's ongoing.
It sort of calls back to the dead internet theory. I was reading about this recently, obviously, like it was 2016 being the last year where everything was normal, of course. And, you know, any given comment section of, like, say, Facebook, for example, maybe 5 people out of 100 will be actual people. And then comes in the question of the content as well. As like, people are already getting tricked by AI content into thinking that's actual real content, maybe of an older generation as, like, a stereotype. But once you bring in the people to that, in addition to the content itself, that brings a real sort of moral question into it.
A moral question, and also just, I think that there's a... You know, with all these things, the pattern we often talk about is you can use a technology and you can try to update based on the way things work currently now, or you can realize what it fundamentally changes. And it's like, you know, AI music can be a really interesting thing, right? And that's an interesting thing. What's not great is fake AI, fake accounts on Spotify that make you think it's a real person when they're actually not. There's a continuing like pattern around all of this.
The interesting thing is that I came across Firefly Entertainment Oreo, and Firefly, a Swedish company, was contracting a lot of people, a handful of writers actually, to generate all these fake profiles with, and writers that could literally produce about 200-300 tracks a year, which is not so challenging to do, and then release that music under fake Spotify account names, fake writer names. And when you look at the leading Spotify playlists that are all mood listening, so where Spotify has realized most people do the blind listening thing, and it doesn't matter what writer is on that playlist, because people generally never look further. And I think Spotify realized it's like, as long as you have vocal music, you're interested in who's singing. But if you have instrumental music, it doesn't really matter who made the music. And Spotify realized that from behavioral listening. They figured, okay, why do we pay real composers, you know, real royalties on our big playlists? Instead, what we'll do is we'll buy music from these companies like Firefly, which they don't really own, but they pay a fraction of royalty, which normally is about 10%. Of a regular stream by positioning that music on these very, very popular, as they call it, Spotify editorial playlists. And this was trickling in already about, I have to say, it became quite much worse about 5 years ago. 4 years ago was kind of a turning point where half of the music was AI, or let's say fake writers positioned. And now we're up to 100%. So if you go to the big playlist like Peaceful Piano, Peaceful Guitar, the big playlist called Sleep, it's 100% fake writers. So there is no opportunity anymore for real composers to say, I want to make this type of music and I want it to land on this Spotify editorial playlist. It's the business is quite doomed in that regard.
Yeah.
It just seems to be getting worse.
And I think it's interesting as well, the number of different industries that find themselves in that pattern, so to speak, where it's kind of, it's not just that it's short term, it works, but it starts to create a persistent problem. So it's interesting as well. I think 2024 was the first year when all of the top 10 movies in the world by box office were sequels. So we're kind of getting to a place where the entertainment industry is becoming really, really poor at producing the new thing that can get some traction around. And some degree that makes sense because so much of their innovation is focused on this kind of stuff, which is finding ways to roll out the old thing in a more cost-effective way. And it's that, you know, you hear that in the movie industry. There's interesting things we've picked up from talking to brands in sport around even things like big football, soccer, for those outside the UK, whereby they've become global super brands, but they're starting to break the link, the kind of intergenerational link of fandom that happens inside families, because the kids, you can no longer afford to take your kids in the same way, which means the transmission doesn't happen, which means that more and more your fan base becomes international, but therefore much more interchangeable, right? Because it's not like you have that kind of three generation back sort of support or background. So there's a lot of key choices for leadership teams right now around, actually, there's the thing that can drive success in the kind of short to medium term, and there's the thing that might make long-term success, and trying to find your path between those is, you know, a key question for a lot of teams just now, I think. And AI just accelerates all of that, because frankly, there's a lot of ways you can get a really good valuation in the next 6 months by just doing old thing plus AI equals big valuation. That definitely works right now if you're doing an investment round. And equally, if you're a big corporation, you can get some good buzz by selling that story. And it's amazing how many CEOs, and I'll call out Klarna for this, are out just now saying that they're not hiring anymore because everything's going to be AI, but they still have a jobs board that seems to be hiring jobs, right? So there's a story a lot of people want to sell, which is AI can make everything radically more efficient very quickly. At some point, you have to come back to the question of, are you actually making a good thing? And are you making a thing that's going to sustain itself because people want it to be there in the future?
Isn't it the Rick Rubin that said it's the power of taste? And it's like your ability you have to express yourself in a way that's meaningful to others.
I find that incredible.
So in a way, it's not so much about, with AI and music, it's not so much about your musical abilities anymore. It's being able to express yourself in a way that becomes meaningful to other people. I also think, like, in what way do we face in this industry the appreciation of the digital connection these days? Because it's been so an overabundance during COVID that we say, okay, we're getting all these emails, these messages, like these, you know, PMs in your Instagram. Like, have you become to a point where it's so saturated that you don't appreciate them anymore? And we actually go back fundamentally to the human connection and say, okay, this is what we truly appreciate. Even if that human connection is just talking about your daily life on a Zoom call, but it's really the connection between two people, I think. The first thing I said, label session, oh my God, Edinburgh, that's great. I love the city. So that was for me in the first days, just saying, oh, that's going to be fun. You know, I was that connection that I felt was most valuable from our first interaction.
Kind of leads us nicely into this thing that we've been seeing. There's been a lot of chat online about really the growing loneliness and social isolation epidemic that has come with these digital connections in this digital space. And in an article in Atlantic, we saw this exploration into how the decline in face-to-face communication has really brought about this erosion of social trust. And this need to prioritize human connection and community. How can we really reimagine technology to start fostering connection rather than isolation? Is that something that's even possible?
I just think one of the things that's so apparent now across everything is that there's a huge pent-up demand for places or opportunities for people to connect. Which you see across all kinds of things. And I think to Vince's point, in a big way, that comes into a demand for real world connection, as in going to a physical place and doing something together with other people, which stretches as a pattern across, in terms of live entertainment and the arts and all these kind of things. It also stretches into all over the world, brands are starting to pop up experiences and are finding they're getting lots of traction from it. And sometimes that's because they've created a very unique experience. Sometimes I think it's just because people are looking for that experience or going to a physical space. Yeah. But one of the things that's really interesting, if you look at all the research around this, is that the social trend itself is really interesting, right? So in terms of technology means that we can be at home in some sense without being lonely. We can still be talking to other people and we can still be, you know, interacting. But there's a real sense of dislocation But that seems to come out even in terms of people finding it hard to meet up. So there's something that that culturally has got broken as we've got so digital. People seem to sort of, you know, find it hard to arrange to meet up, even though the tools should have made that easier than ever. There's a sort of cultural thing that's got broken.
It's like, I've spoken to you on WhatsApp every day this week. I don't need to see you in person.
It's all about the psyche of the individual, right? It's like, how do they deal with it? How do they flourish through certain types of contact? And that's so different for everyone. So diverse as well. But I can also really understand when people say, this is enough. I really want to get out of there again. There's too much distraction. There's too much virtual. There's too much, too little human connection. And I think that's something that I do face myself. And in a sense, it's like, yeah, I want to get out, have a real meeting again. And that's why I said to Nick, so I'll say, film something. I'll come over. I'll do a flag. Doesn't matter. It's a good excuse. Fly to any excuse to get out of the house, get away from the computer and stuff as well. And we see it dwindling VR sales as well. What's up with that? I think Web3, the metaverse, we see it. There's a lot of money that's being pumped into this by Zuckerberg. I don't know, Nick, if you can talk about this because you'll know a lot more about this. But, you know, what do we already see people a lot in the metaverse? Is this a very empty space? Is people more and more adopting to using VR tech, or do we actually still see it, you know, dwindling VR sales and people hesitant towards more and more distractions, you know?
So yeah, so like if you consider the amount that's been invested, there's still quite a small section of the world that is embracing the metaverse, certainly, or going into these different environments. I think it's an interesting tension that people might be thinking as they listen to this, because if you research, if you do classic service design or whatever, you go and research what consumers are asking for, you will pick up that they are really resistant at the moment to talking to someone, talking to a call center, going into a branch, or any of that kind of stuff. You always get lots of resistance to. So, you know, that is true, right? And on the flip side, the thing I think was really good about Derek Thompson's article in the Atlantic and some of the stuff that's been around the discussion of this is, across lots of big data points, you can see that people are feeling more isolated, whether you use the word lonely or not, but they also want to meet up with people more often. So both of those things are true. So I think it's a really interesting sort of pattern for us to get our head around, which is, it's a bigger deal, I guess, really, is what we're saying. It's a much bigger deal now than it used to be for any of us to create an experience that requires someone to go out of the house and go and meet someone. Because that used to be a thing that was happening all the time, and people are doing it less, pretty much across all over the world. But on the flip side, know that if you can persuade someone to do that, it's so much more meaningful than it was before. So I think that's a really interesting challenge. And I think a sort of fundamental thing that's just really exciting us now is embrace the new technology, but build it around an experience that isn't based on the screen. Which is sound is sort of your world, absolutely, Vincent. But I think there's just a lot around that in terms of using AI. How can you use AI to spot a moment that's meaningful to somebody and to create something respond to them in some way? So how can you do that rather than it being around trying to optimize every part of some UX experience so that you kind of maximize click through on a particular instance? You know, there's just a flip in the way we think about this.
And a lot of brands are doing this now. They're trying to sort of create community around a brand. So instead of an audience or a client, it's a community, and they're looking for different ways to create that, whether it is with the same store sound across every single store or the same experience that you know when you that comfort of familiarity. Which, you know, is huge for brands.
Come out of familiarity, but also I think it's a great time to be really niche or to be quite esoteric. Because essentially, if you can start to build a community of people who know they are unusual because they're so into that thing, whether it's like a podcast group or some unusual whiskey or something like that, those communities you start to find really almost like mobilizing themselves. They're sort of really eager to try and be more important in the world or just to establish the fact that they exist. You know, that's a real interesting trend.
Which throws back to your point about sort of message boards and things becoming back into fashion, because things like Reddit haven't died away. people are more active and more busy in these niche forums. And, you know, spend hours and hours and hours communicating about the most, I mean, I'm one of them, you know, so that's right in there talking about, you know, Real Housewives of Atlanta, it's there. But you sort of find your niche community, which is interesting when you have that ability, but you also have this increase in isolation and loneliness. So it's those two things that are sort of the balance between those is an interesting space for us culturally. We've kind of been talking a little bit about backlash, and one of the other things that's really been popping up on all of our timelines and all of our feeds recently is this idea of greenlashing. And this is the backlash against sustainability initiatives because of this idea that it's actually undermining and inhibiting progress. So it's the idea that political, cultural, economic resistance is leading to roadblocks and various blockers for people to actually make anything happen. It's not to be confused with greenwashing, which I know is what Nick, you were talking about earlier, which is its own issue. But this, how do we feel about this sort of growing resistance to the way sustainability is suddenly being framed? So sustainability is suddenly being framed as the problem.
And I think also there's a misunderstanding at the heart I've heard around as well, because I think in terms of there's a lot of people in companies who are now saying because of the change in political climate in America that ESG no longer matters. And the thing that's interesting in that is even if we're being coldly commercial, do not forget that supply chain accountability is still going to be a big deal. That's part of the driver there. So in terms of it might be that some of your political masters, if you're in certain markets in the world, are no longer going to be asking quite as much about sustainability. But they're going to be asking about things like made in America. They're going to be asking about where the connections to, in that case, the Chinese supply chain. So there's a whole, that way of doing business, the new normal, if you like, is still absolutely going to be relevant. That's there. As for the, you know, the parts of the world and the industries and the people who are going to care about the sustainability agenda in an ongoing way, obviously it matters in large parts of the world. It still matters to financial institutions. It's interesting. So in terms of if you work in insurance, you definitely care about sustainability still, all these different issues. I think the thing that the whole sector has to get its head around is that there's so little trust between companies and brands and people who care about sustainability that is where there's a real issue now, because for a while, there was this accusation of greenwashing. In practice, the accusation of greenwashing was leveled against almost any company that was trying to make a change, which therefore means that the incentive, you know, it became quite a difficult comms journey for a brand that wanted to change ground. That we need to find a way of, well, I think we need to find a way for brands to walk through that journey more effectively. And culturally, I think we need to find a way of accepting that not everybody is necessarily involved in a conspiracy to screw the planet at all times. This might be there.
Which we're currently seeing right now with the wildfires in the US, right? Where it has gone from a tragedy and an event that's happening to just streams of conspiracy theories about various things that have caused it. I think I've seen more conspiracy theories in actual news coverage. Like, how do you reframe something that's become so politicized?
Yeah. Politicized and polarized. It's just like everyone's versions of the truth are so diverse, I guess, the positive. But just like the people are living in very different bubbles.
Yeah, we were just talking about smart cities, and there was the thing that popped up immediately, right? And I just came across this little documentary video on Masdar City, MASDAR in Dubai, and how it's... has been used as for a long period of time as this poster child of sustainability city, and how it literally fundamentally just doesn't work. And I see the projects by NEOM in Saudi Arabia and all super exciting, but Masdar City has been, first of all, struggling with attracting any kind of foreign investors because it's simply too expensive for its location and to be maintained. There's a university, there's a Siemens building as well, which is the headquarter for sustainability in UAE, which is now positioned in Masdar City. And basically they see no one truly wanting to live there for a simple reason, because there is no genuine community. So the fear of I think Los Angeles turning into to a future city is maybe far off, because they simply don't work from an investment point of view. And that's what Masdar City has shown to be. People pay with their privacy. It's something that where only students live who are studying sustainability at the university there at Masdar City, but simply leave once they finish their studies. There's some very interesting articles about it. One of the first true experiences when it comes to smart cities. And yeah, I still think maybe this is also a sign that people want to come back to genuine interaction and real world experiences, and smart cities don't seem to offer that feel of true community. That's what I feel.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also there's a step for everybody that's involved in, you know, the broader scene of ESG and making companies more sustainable, is also recognizing that, I guess, there's a proportion of the world that is going to become true believers in the whole thing. There's a proportion of the world that might be resistant to some of the messages, but actually can be partners in the change. So there's a lot of research we do with end consumers. And there's undoubtedly a big audience. And I guess we've been mostly Europe, UK, America. But there's a big audience of people who will tell you that they're not into green things and they don't buy things for green reasons. And then you ask them about changes they want to make in their lives. And they're like, I really want to buy an EV because it's cheaper. I really want to insulate my house if it's in a cold country because I don't like paying heating bills. You know, there's a whole bunch of things where they're making green changes, but just not doing it with the explicit label of that. And I think there's something for the whole scene of people who want to build sustainable changes, is to recognize that there's definitely, you know, as a group, and it's a good thing if lots of people buy into the whole agenda. But we also need to find ways of making the right choice a really simple choice for people to make in the real world scenarios, which is they're just trying to make the house run a bit cheaper. To Vince's point, they're trying to do fun things, and like, how can the fun thing be the more sustainable thing rather than necessarily, you know, whether it's flying halfway around the world or whatever else? How can we start to make the green choices good choices is the kind of path that we need to get to.
What do you think is the major source of doubt, or in terms of believing even that climate change is real? Like, what are the tricky, where is all the conspiracy theories? Where are they getting their information to the point where it becomes this mass
opposition? Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, I've never done a big study of this, but whenever I've been researching it for projects we do with people, I think their opposition is less about, I don't believe the climate change is real, or some people will say that. But they don't. I think a bigger objection is, I don't believe that we can make a difference. I don't believe that anything's going to change, that we're going to get there. It's a real left field example, but no judgment, but I occasionally read weird books. And the other week I read A History of Cheating in Chess, which is quite weird. But it had this really good example in it, which is quite relevant now, because there was this chess tournament that was running in London. And the way it worked was that you had important people playing chess, but they had a chess master advising them. Or no, they were supposed to guide them rather than advise them as they went through the game. And they had an MP who at the time was the opposition spokesman, but is now our Chancellor of the Exchequer in the UK, Rachel Reeves, playing with, I think it was Garry Kasparov, as her kind of guys. And she won the tournament. And afterwards, people were saying, we think you were guided too much, because you didn't start very well, and then you came through really strongly at the end. And Garry Kasparov said, no, I actually didn't say anything. I said one thing, which is, we got to a certain point in the game when I could see it opening up. And all I said was, wow. And then Rachel spent a minute working out the different moves, and then made the move and started to take over. And I think that's really interesting for all these things. It's not just that you kind of buy into the story. You need to believe actually you could make the transition. So I think the point in that story is, she suddenly realized, well, from this point, I can definitely win. I didn't know anything about how, but I just recognized that somebody who knows what they're talking about said, wow. And I kind of think it's similar on sustainability. People need to have confidence that the transition point is winnable. So it's not like we're onto a losing thing. We need someone important to have a wow moment, or someone convincing to say, actually, we could do this. think that's the tipping point.
That's really interesting.
I don't think we fully realize that there are people who are seeing different realities to us every single day. So it's that belief that there can be a transition, but there's also just the information you see receiving is so different depending on what you believe or on which side of a topic you fall. Because immediately the algorithm shifts to just that. You don't see anything. You just see that. So it's very difficult to shift out of your belief because it seems like the whole world is with you. The whole world's agreeing with you. So surely, you know, smart cities and 5G are going to kill you.
I find this problem of AI in general also that so often there's a lot of videos of, you see a lot of people debating their own thoughts to ChatGPT, and it just reemphasizes whatever weird beliefs you have. And I'm just like, yeah, what is this popularity of just wanting to hear that you're right? Is this also an addiction? You want to hear, yeah, this echo chamber type of, you know, mentality. When does AI actually serve critical thinking and critical responses and say, no, I disagree. I want a ChatGPT that does that.
Basically, AI distinguishes between being a very rich person that just has loads of yes men around them. It's just like, it's like whatever idea you have is great and it can work out.
That brings us to sort of one of our wrap-up questions. And I just wanted to touch base with everyone and see, you know, if you can let me know, how weird are you?
Oh, this is the return of the questions from the series.
Quick fire questions. So we've been talking about really weird things right now. So I kind of want to get a gauge on where you all sit.
Be weird until the point where other people will find you very uncomfortable. but don't go over that line of uncomfortableness. When weird is eccentric, it could be still construed as useful. And I always say it'd be a little bit of a clown, because very often when you speak with affluential people, they have this tendency to find people quite boring because they've lived it all, seen it all, heard it all. And therefore, sometimes I feel like be the clown that with the little flower that like just goes and does that in someone's face. I'm not saying spit in someone's face, but I'm just
right.
Scared of care, people. Yeah. Vincent Corvez said, "Do not spit in people's faces."
That's what we can do with T-shirts.
But be the clown that has that one moment where the flower does like, and that makes you more memorable. And if and that sometimes that has kind of an edge of weirdness to it, because that is what I think very often influential people like connect to, because it's like, that's, oh, this is strange. Like I've never experienced this before. And that gives you like an edge of uniqueness or eccentricness or just, and I do that through my music. I'll be honest. I think that leaves a little legacy in a conversation and a little moment of remembrance and an appreciation. And sometimes you have to be a bit more daring to come up with something weird and not follow always the perfect trend and the perfect wave and the perfect, because that's boring.
Yeah, maybe this comes back to it. It's like unless you're over 3 on the weird scale, it's no longer worth doing anything, because AI can just do a version of you anyway. So it's like the kind of 3.5 to 5 is the only like surviving like possibility to be territory, I think, you know.
It's now just originality, not weirdness. Josh, Nick, how weird are you?
I don't know how I followed that up, frankly. Honestly, all the good points have been taken, but it feels like an Alcoholics Anonymous group. Like, hi, I'm Josh, and I'm a weirdo.
Yeah.
It's good. This is a safe space for you, Josh. It's a very safe space for you.
I think that should be the final word of the whole episode, I think, Josh. That's fine. That's fine.
Everything we do from now on is
interpolate a score from that.
Awesome. thank you for joining us. We hope today's conversations have given you a fresh perspective and a few ideas to challenge the status quo. If you want to get access to label sessions for your brand or have your teams mentored by our leaders, get in touch via our website or any of the social networks around. See you next week.